10 seconds late.
Hey, I know who's on the empty with the stars tonight.
Oh, who?
Oh. All right.
The secretary call the roll.
Kit's not here. Malcolm. Robin.
Yes.
Bill.
Here.
Jim.
Yes.
Margaret.
Here.
Harold.
Yes.
Gordy.
Here.
Jack.
I'm fine.
Great. Okie dokie.
Very good. So our next item is the consent calendar. We have three sets of minutes?
No, we only have one.
We only have one set of minutes.
Which is?
That'll make it real easy.
May 9th.
May 9th. Everybody got a copy of those by email, so is anybody that feels there's any additions or corrections to the minutes? Jack?
3 months down the road, how could we possibly remember?
Hey, we have faith in you guys. No problem.
Move to approve.
Okay, it's been moved to approve. Is there a second?
Second.
Discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. So our next ones will be June 13th and July 18th. Okay, next item on the agenda is the status of recommendations for the BCC. I went to the Board Commissioner meeting, I don't think it was last Thursday, it was a Thursday that the Board of Commissioners had an update from David on the planning. And David did a good job of trying to get the board to move forward on the recommendations. And bottom line is, Sandy has not read at all any of the recommendations that were given to them on June 14th, I believe. Simon had sort of read them, but not in any detail. And of course, Dwight's out of the picture. So at this point in time, there's no action being taken by the board, and there won't be until Sandy reads the recommendations, and there's no guarantee that she's going to read them or whatever. So I'm not sure where to go with this. And David, I think, tried real hard to come up with trying to get some direction, and they were not willing to give him any direction. And unfortunately, he can't move without them giving him some indication of where to go. He will be meeting with them again on this Thursday at another planning update, which is, I believe, in the afternoon. I think it's there. Is it their afternoon?
Usually has his meetings in the morning.
In the morning?
Mm-hmm.
So I'll check the agenda, but if there's somebody that can go, I've got to be over to meet in Jackson County at the same time. The Jackson County Planning Commission is dealing with their regional problem-solving thing, so I can't get to that meeting. So if there was somebody that could at least be there, I was at that meeting. I didn't get and speak at all. But it just they're just my impression of reading it is there's just not going to be any movement by this board.
What is the meeting?
It's Thursday, either morning or afternoon. I thought I had my schedule with me, but it's usually their staff. It's their admin meeting, and I believe it's in the morning.
It's 9 a.m. In the morning.
Is it possible to email it to us?
Yes.
I will forget about
yes.
it.
Yes, I will do that.
Okay.
Good. Because it would be good to have somebody there and see what he I talked to David today, and he was going to bring it back up again. Try to see if they can get some movement on it at this point in time. So
can't we get some kind of thing where they don't make a decision with an X number of days and we just get to go ahead with
it? Well, the problem is that they need to really have a meeting with David to go through this, and they haven't even scheduled that at this point in time. And that's where they need to be, is have that meeting with his as a staff person to review, and then direct him to move into the Plan Commission hearing. That's the proper process, and that's. They haven't even had the meeting with David, and I don't think they will until they probably have read it. But.
I think David's going to bring that up this Thursday at the 11th.
Yeah, he said he was.
Okay,
yeah.
It's 9 o'clock. It's at Ambassador.
Ambassador.
And if you please, you know,
in Ambassador.
So can
pardon me?
In Ambassador.
Yes, it is.
No, it's Ambassador.
9 a.m. Ambassador.
Taped one or televised one, I guess. I think they televised it.
Yes, they do.
No, they have their staff meeting. They have regular staff. They have staff meeting, administrative meetings, and legal meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And then the regular public session is on a Wednesday. This Wednesday is at 5:30 a.m. But
so legal could you just, every Tuesday.
Yeah. So could you just sort of email everybody and let them know the time,
mm-hmm.
and see what happens. So I'm not very encouraged by it, quite frankly, as to where we should be going as a committee in relationship to this. Because to me, you need to see some movement on these issues because I think our time and your folks' time is so that is more valuable than us running through this, and if we're not going to get anywhere, I think our decision is going to be, do we keep going or do we just sort of hold our tent and sit back for a while and see what comes out of this?
Well, yeah, I want to echo that. I mean, I said to Robin on the way in tonight, it's like, you know, I hate to think that we put all this time into it and we're going to keep having these meetings just so it disappears out of black hole. But given what the state of the situation is with the county commissioners right now, I don't have a real positive feeling that what we've spent a lot of time on, serious time, is going to get a fair consideration. And, you know, I went through this in the last year with the city. I was on a committee to review the transportation SDC. When we presented it to the city council, they were all, yeah. And then it just disappeared off the radar. And it was only because, you know, a couple of people carried the water for us, but a couple of people on the committee went in and said, damn it, you know, we spent a lot of time on this, and we're not prepared to see it disappear into the ether. And I think that's what's going to happen here, too, that we have to advocate for the work that we've done. The difference is that right now we have this flux going on with the county commissioner situation, and Commissioner Castanelli never even signed off on this committee in the first place. So, but I personally feel, I'm sure like everybody else in this room, I've got lots of things to devote my time to, and I don't want to spend any more time on this until I get some feedback that what we're doing is going to be at least examined. If they examine it and say, we don't like it, throw it out, that'd be hard to take, but it would be at least legitimate. But the idea that we're going to do all this and nobody's even going to look at it is, that isn't. So I don't feel like I really want to attend a bunch more meetings, much as I enjoy meeting with all of you, until I feel like this, what we're doing is going to be treated with the seriousness that we treated it with.
My recommendation tonight was to put this committee on hold till the October meeting. That gives us September, August, and September. And tentatively, we have a meeting set for October. And if nothing has happened in that period of time, I guess the best thing would be to recommend that they dissolve the committee. Because I would agree. I don't want
to. But I would say that if any of you can make the Thursday meeting, to just stand up and say, you know, basically what I've just said. Hey, I don't know what you've been doing for the last year, but we've been putting a lot of effort in this, and we just need to get a look at it.
Jack.
I want to echo what Gordon said, but I also want to point out that it seems to me that what we've brought forward is important. I'm aware of two different cases already involving this deer overlay, which we've advocated. So, I mean, we're not talking about abstract concepts you know, keeping ourselves entertained. But I think we're addressing things that are real. Just regarding the deer overlay, months ago, we went but requested
three months
that
ago.
They, in fact, get this into planning for the next step. And, you know, nothing has happened. So...
So how did the rest of you feel? I guess that was my belief, is that we don't have a meeting in September and wait for our next meeting to be in October, depending on, and then leave that as a tentative, and if nothing happens, either have a meeting and decide whether we want to continue forward or pack our bags and move on to some things that we need to be doing. So
I think that's a good idea, but I'd like to echo what these two guys said. I also think, you know, we put an awful lot of time and sweat and energy into this and different subcommittees and stuff, and I think some good stuff has come out of this, and I just hate to see it, you know, evaporate into thin air. And also, this morning at another meeting I was at, it was brought up about a scenario that had just happened over in Jackson County where I guess there was a gentleman that had he had rented his house as a vacation rental. Mm-hmm. And there is no vacation rental status that had ever been drafted in either Jackson or Josephine County. And Rubenstein heard this case, and Rubenstein said, well, since it isn't on our books and it hasn't ever been decided as an ordinance, then it doesn't exist, and you can't do it. And I think that that's the type of thing that I'd hate to see happen in Josephine County. is if you have somebody that's got a, you know, a riverfront home site, and say they wanted to, you know, I mean, if you can lease it out by the month.
So wait a minute, Jim. So what they're saying, what is not permitted is forbidden?
Is forbidden.
That's, right.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what he said.
It was not in the law.
You can.
That is so wrong.
So I was kind of hoping that we, through this committee, could come up with some language that would prevent at least that from happening, or at least, you know, it could meet some litmus test. Because I know owning a motel and some property along the Illinois River and stuff, that, I mean, there's been times where our motel was overflowed and that house was available on the river, and we rented the house for a week, you know. And now if I found out that in Josephine County I'm in violation and could be fined for renting my house for a week, yeah, fine.
Part of it comes back to us that have been in business for a long time. Is Jackson County has always had that attitude, is we're going to throw you under the bus unless it's expressly permitted. Where Josephine County is going to say, well, there's no law to prevent you from leasing your house for a week or a month. You know, as long as it's one kitchen, one house, you know, where is there a problem? Why would you even bother? And I know this one was because of a complaint from a neighbor.
Yeah.
But Jackson County's always been that way. Yeah, that's nothing new.
It's a home away from home program, by the way, is what this guy was operating under.
You know, and I heard a thing this morning on the radio that a couple have a house, and they contacted over the internet a couple over in Paris. And they decided they're going to swap houses for a week or 2 weeks. I don't see that there's a problem. It's one house, one family, one kitchen. You're going to have the same impacts whether you're having somebody live there permanently or whether they're there on a temporary basis. Now, if you're adding additional dwelling units there, that's a different situation. But that's not the... not the way it's happened.
Again, I think it's going to be important. I would hope that we, even if we don't meet between now and, say, October, that there are some issues that we ought to keep our hands on. And I think it would be important to, and myself included, would be to keep reminding the board that we need to be doing something on this, that this is not something that should just lay down and go away. And they meet every 2 weeks with the planning director. So that this would be his first meeting in August, and then you'll have another one 2 weeks from this Thursday.
I'll try and be there for him on Thursday, too.
But, Jack?
This came up, it's actually in the minutes, on page 4, where somebody raised this question right here as to whether we should address it. And I think it was Malcolm. Drake was upset that this could compromise some of his activities. And we, on the basis that it's not addressed at all in our comp plan and noise about it, we decided to just support it as a sleeping dog. But Rubenstein and Jackson County have brought it to life again. So what I propose is that we have on the agenda for October discussion of language. What I would propose is that we build it into our comp plan that if it isn't forbidden, you can do it. And that's just the standard for application.
Okay. Am I recognized? I want to point out that on page 6-3 in the code, there
which,
is...
What page?
6-3, chapter 6, very first three pages. Under 60.060, similar uses, it's very explicit. The planning director may rule that an unlisted use is allowed within a given zone if the following criteria are met. The proposed use is not listed as a use of any kind. The proposed use is similar to one or more listed uses. Uses are similar if their general activities are alike and the resulting impacts are similar in type and intensity, and the request for a similar use is part of a specific development proposal for the zone. So it's already in the code.
Yeah.
I would suggest that what we want to do is address that as another.
You don't think it's already explicit right here?
Well, I think the problem is, Grace, that I suspect that under the current regime, if you'll put the term David, I think that he would be probably generous enough to say, well, for instance, in the instance that Bob was talking about, this post-exchange situation, that falls into a similar situation. You have one family, one house, no added traffic, no added impact, or whatever. I would see him interpreting it under that provision that, hey, yeah, this is permitted. In the past, I can see somebody going, wow, this is a whole new ballgame. So it really comes down to the interpretation of the individual director, which you would like to think. I mean, that's one of our ongoing complaints as builders is that can't you stand here and make a decision? But at the same time, you don't like the decision. If you have somebody that's very, rigid and has that perspective, you may not get the decision that you would think would be common sense. So I think that does cover it. On the other hand, I can see where there should be, take it one more notch, which, like Jack says, is that, hey, if you can't show me in the code where it says I can't do this, then your obligation is to go to the Planning Commission and the County Commissioners and have it put in the code. In the meantime, it's legal.
Yeah.
I have is if it's a type 1 or type 2 or type 3 type.
It's allowed if the proposed use is not listed as a use and then they specify permitted, conditional use, or temporary use in any other zone. Wait a minute. In any other zone, that's a little bit tricky too. And I was also thinking the language, which means we probably should clarify some of this. The implication here is that it has to be part, you have to ask for a development permit. So if you've already got all your permits, you built your house, you've done everything right, and then you start renting it out as a vacation rental, you can't just do it. You have to go and apply.
Yeah, that's
and I don't think that's necessary, because so it's like, again, it's the same use.
So I guess my suggestion, because I'd agree with you, that it needs to be clarified probably better, and if there's somebody that would at least want to look at that and provide us with some language that might be more clear than this and more specific, that we could then make a recommendation to them.
So there's got to be another county that has dealt with this.
No, I don't think they have. I think this is one of those that slipped through.
I think there are extremes. I mean, you have situations like Sun River where vacation rentals are a huge deal, really have to deal with it on a daily basis, and then you have counties where whoever wants to go there, so who cares?
Yeah. Peggy?
I think instead of necessarily referring to this specific case, I like what Jack suggested, saying that if it's not, and Gordon also, that if it's not prohibited, then it's allowed. And I think that language will cover enough.
Well, let's do this. Let's put it on our agenda for next the October meeting, and then between now and then, if you have some thoughts on language, specific languages, bring it to that meeting for us for discussion, and we'll put it on as an action item.
So what we could do is, anybody wants to work on email the rest of the committee. Don't respond or you'll be in violation of the public meeting law. At least, but you could put the proposals perhaps are.
But the best thing probably would be to submit them to Ann and have her then distribute it out to people. Do you think? Is that still, would that work? So that we have a...
So we aren't doing, what do they call that when the city did that?
Well, it still would. I think it still would even under that scenario. I think what he's talking about is that when you start communicating and making changes...
You can't discuss it back and forth.
Yeah.
You can notify in.
Yeah.
And if anybody... Prisoners, I said, now, here's my proposal for how to handle it. Send it to everybody. And if somebody has a question, a suggestion, an observation, a criticism, whatever, back to me personally, and there's no quorum involved. If they, at that point, reply to everybody, then all of a sudden it's discussion, you've got a quorum, and you're in violation of it.
Well, that's why I was saying if people had some ideas or drafts or thoughts, that the best way is to send it to Ann, have her create a folder on this issue, and then it can be redistributed back out at some point, and that then there's at least a gathering spot and we don't get ourselves caught up in trying to make some language changes. So my suggestion is between now and then is to submit any of your comments or ideas to Ann, and I would guess we'd call it a vacation rental issue.
Vacation or incidental.
No, I'm just using it for an identity for being able to gather it, but it would be a general, it would be dealing with things in general, because I do know that we were told years ago that if it's not in the state law, it's not legal. I mean, that was in land use, I should say, that clarify, but that was
there are no property rights.
That's right, yeah. So, anything else on that one? So we're agreeable to move it to our October. Now, the only thing I have there is I see that the October meeting is on Columbus Day. Is that a holiday for you guys? Mm-hmm.
No, it's not for the county.
Okay. So October 10th would be our next meeting. And I think that you were going to be bringing back the erosion thing in September, but we'll just wait till October.
Good thing it was a small time.
I thought maybe you might be ready right
now. No, yeah, right.
Okay. Most of this other stuff, I guess, we'll put on hold at this point. I don't know. Bob has submitted a letter in regards to... did everybody get a copy of it? Has it not got around to you, Asia? Is there any more extra copies over there? I don't think we need any action on it today, but I think it's the work that Bob... Why don't you explain, Bob, what you've done?
The issue is about establishing a threshold to determine a break between non-resource lands and commercial timber. Because there was a change in the OAR recently that says you have to, in all cases, go to the NRCS soil survey and use their cubic foot per acre per year or identifying forest land, but they never made a threshold saying how many cubic feet it is to identify forest land one way or another. So we have to use that, and what that has done is put the county's IRR system that they've used to identify forest land for years, it puts that in jeopardy. We really don't know how it applies anymore. And the concern that I have after talking to one of the staff members up in the state is they're going to be talking to state forestry and try and establish a bright line of anything above this is forest land and anything below this is not. And it's been my experience that they try and have the bar very low. So I talked with Jim, and he put me in contact with people at Rough and Ready Petrol Forest. I've talked to people at Indian Hill. I looked at some of the things in Jackson County. Talked to Keith Kubik at Douglas County. And there's no real hard line of where it is.
That was interesting to me.
So part of it is with the county not really being able to use the IRR system. Or do we have to use that plus the new state identification where there's no clear bright line? How do we identify the difference between non-resource land and commercial forest land? As we saw early on in this process, there's thousands of acres that were rezoned that really don't have much in the way of resource potential. So if we're trying to bring that out, how do we fix it?
I think the frustrating thing about this for me is having sat in on the initial creation of the IRR system in the county with Larry Brown, who was the author and the person that put it together. And when he did that, the state of Oregon and LCDC and DLCDC, Jim Ross was the director at that time, was having a real battle with it. They could not and would not accept it originally. And we had a meeting down in here in Grants Pass over at the old planning office on which was the Washington School. We had every expert from governmental agencies involving the forests and timber issues in the room. the Department of Forestry, maybe BLM had some folks. There was, must have been about seven or eight, and all of them came, and also DLCD had some, apparently some staff, I remember some staff people that were supposedly experts in the determination of forest resource land, and they all came loaded to bury us on this IRR system that Larry put together. And after a full day of spending time with myself, Larry Brown, and I think Bruce Bartow was the director at the time.
Yeah, he was there.
Were in the room, and they kept going outside, they being the government folks, kept going out of the room and conferencing, and they'd come back. And what had happened is Larry Brown had taken all of their data and all of their research and used their data and their research and their experts to come up with a system. And so they were having trouble attacking their system. And at the end of the day, all these experts said, we agree with you. This is an excellent system for determining the difference between commercial and non-commercial forest land. And that was how the IRR got started. And Jim Ross's only issue was, we don't want this to be something for the whole state because it would really create problems throughout the whole state if this was adopted for as a state requirement. So we gave him some language, and I can't remember the language now, that identified it solely for Josephine County. And But it really irritates me that all of a sudden LUBA and some folks that have absolutely no forestry experience all of a sudden have destroyed a system that was created by the state's own, basically approved and agreed to by the state's own experts. And it would never change because of the data that they use. And it was not to determine whether land should be developed and built on. It was to determine what was really true exclusive farmland. And it was a good system. It really worked, and it was working. And unfortunately, now we've lost all that. And, you know, Larry's dead, and I don't know whether any of his material is even around anymore. But
well, Michael's report really established that it works, you know. Yeah. But when he submitted that to the person who now took Ron Eber's place at DLCD,
Richard Whitney?
Catherine Daniels.
Catherine Daniels. He said, when he got back to her months later, she hadn't even read it. You know, another case, they just dismissed it out of hand without even looking at it. And then I think the rogue advocates are attacking it because it's not flexible. But none of land use is flexible. So that's kind of a...
Well, none of them are experts. Yeah. I mean, there's nobody on that left that I'm aware of.
I think
the frustrating thing that we've lost what I consider one of the best systems. And so did the state's experts at that time. This was back in the 80s, I believe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's unfortunate. Jack?
Well, all that being the case, I guess it sounds important because, again, it's a recurring problem in this county, this zoned land. We have some volunteers and put together a meeting.
The discussion on that, the whole OAR change was, quote, under the guise of housekeeping that they did up at the state level. And they put it together, and what I'm thinking we need is some political muscle to get to Whitman to adjust the OARs to allow the equivalent IRR system to be in there. Because they go through a list saying that first you have to use the NRCS, and if that isn't accurate or it doesn't clearly identify it, then you go to the Department of Revenue identification of forest land, and if that doesn't do it, you come down to another one, which is from the Forest Service, and so they have a hierarchy of which things that they want you to use. And if we could get the IRR put in there as an alternative, I think that would be fixable, and the Board of County Commissioners can't really do that. And so it's something at the state level that we need, you know, somebody that has the connection with Whitman to walk in and say, here, we've got something. Obviously, your staff didn't have any constructive knowledge of the Josephine County system, and you should be able to put that in and just have it as a change and get it through LCDC. You know, if we had a connection there, I know there's some lady from Central Point that's on the commission, but I don't
know.
She's
off of it.
Oh, she's off? Mm-hmm. No, I don't know if there's any connection there to try and get into ear to hear what we have to say.
Jack?
Well, we could recommend the Board of County Commissioners take the issue up. I understand that the Democratic leader in the Senate recognizes this problem. In their backyard, in Willamette Valley, they're getting a lot of heat over the same issue. So, prospectively, as such, approach our representatives and request them.
There's another possibility, and I don't know if it'll work, but the Oregon Association of Realtors, possibly if it's enough of an issue that we can show that it has effect on properties, I know that his name is Sean Gillians. He has a direct ear to Mr. Whitman. In fact, he is one of the authors of the 3615.
Oh.
And maybe we need to talk about it and see how we could ask for...
I have talked to Sean.
And see if that would... Because if it's statewide enough and then we can put it, then I think it becomes a statewide and OAR could then...
Well, I have a couple of issues with that. Now, Bob sent me the Department of Revenue or the Assessor's Office maps, right? And I don't know why that was selected as the second tier of... Because, I mean, I didn't really look at them closely because my eyes glazed over, but they classify the soils as what, quarter sections?
Based on 40-acre blocks. They're not based on soil types.
No.
Just based on a 40-acre block, what they think the area will grow.
So you've got like a section with a few blocks, squares, that have nothing to do with reality, with the geology of the soils, of anything like that. And then the other issue I have, and I don't know if this is still in there, but in the very last tier, if you're allowed a forester, they have to be a member of two specific organizations. And I talked to Norm Fuller, the one that Bob and I use. He said that to join those organizations, they've got to take 60 more hours of classes continuing credits. And aren't our OSU graduates good enough for the state of Oregon to determine whether or not the soils are forest soils? So those two issues I think are important to bring up, because the Department of Revenue maps are useless, totally useless, and the one about the foresters eliminates 99% of the foresters in the state, if not all of them. I'm not sure. I didn't see any in the list. Oh, I tried to look it up. I didn't see any in the list.
What's interesting about this is you got two private land use consultants that see this, that litmus does not work, and your eyes glaze over, because I do the same thing. And I was thinking to myself, if they're not listening to the land use consultants and they're not listening to the foresters who actually do this, what's the game here,
The game is to make it so the status quo is preserved. They want nothing coming out of resource land. By lowering the bar or making it such that you can't prove the case that it's non-resource.
Well, I've got
that's the whole thing.
In talking with, and you talked with Jennifer about this,
mm-hmm.
they don't even look at the viability of a piece of property until, wasn't it 40? Their scale, 40 cubic feet per acre? That's where they won't even look at it as far as the economic feasibility until it is 40. And the other company, Dr. Swanson, theirs was at 50. So if those two companies, they won't even look at it as being viable commercial forest land until it's 40 cubic feet per acre or 50 cubic feet per acre.
Yeah.
Now, Bob's recommending that we set the bar at 20.
No, I'm not recommending
it. Oh, you're just saying that that's what the state has.
That's where they're headed at.
Because
the Department of Forestry rules say if you can grow 20 cubic feet, if you harvest, you have to restock. If the soils are below 20, you don't have to restock. So if you've got to restock it, well, by God, that's forest land. And you can't save your soul on it. And as I talked to Jennifer and talked to John Krause and the guys, what they said is, yeah, they've got some on the books that's down at 20, but those were pieces of property that were either adjacent to things they already had, or they were in such a size because that it would, you know, fit with their harvest process. But if you take an isolated 40 or an 80 that's around, it's not economically practical. So that's what this is all about, is the states wanting to drop the level to the basement to where everything qualifies as forest land, and therefore there is no zone changes, and they don't have to deal with any of the other stuff of putting houses out there or any of the other issues that, that they just don't want to contend with. It's maintain status quo.
Bob, how is this going to fit with that House Bill 3647, where they're saying they're going to have
3647 is not about forests, that's about farms.
Farms. Okay.
And the 3647 on the farm one, that's another one coming up, is that if you want to go for non-farm dwellings, say you got a portion of the property that's generally unsuitable, if the big maps that NRCS has, and they cannot identify areas smaller than 5 acres, the, per their written thing, it says if you want to show that there's a portion of the property that's generally unsuitable, the first thing you do is contact the Department of Land Conservation and Development in Salem. You ask their permission for you to hire a soil classifier that's on their approved list.
Soil scientist.
Whoa.
And then he goes out and does the report, and then he ships it to Salem for them to review. And if you think that that report is good enough to submit to the local jurisdiction, then they will send a certified copy down to the local jurisdiction to look at.
They're basically cutting.
And they're
going
to charge you a fee to do that. And yeah. The explanation I got from Catherine is, well, there's some people that have never found a good farm soil, so they'll approve everything. So we've got to protect that from happening, so we're going to review every soil report that's submitted for every jurisdiction.
Don't they do that anyway?
And they'll charge a fee for it.
They do that anyway after it's approved, and then they can appeal. You know, every farm use has got to be sent up to DLCD.
Well, the county has a reporting requirement, but they don't necessarily submit every complete application up to the state for them to review and appeal. And what happens is if they see a bunch of these, then it gets into an enforcement order process saying that you're approving things frivolously. So
well, I guess the only thing I want to say about this and about a lot of the other things that we've talked about here is that a lot of it that we think is important and that we're trying to impact on really falls under that category of, you know, rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. We see this as important, and we want to move this from here to here, and if we just change this, it would make things work a lot better here. I don't know how many of you in this room spend very much time in Portland or deal with people north, Eugene and north. I don't. I used to live in Portland, and so I have a little bit of an understanding of the northern Oregon mentality. And being very involved with the State Home Builders Association, I'm 3 or 4 times a year I'm at state home builders meetings where I'm, you know, interacting with home builders who are very sympathetic to most of our points of view, but they're from around the state. And the real problem is that there are two Oregons. There is the Oregon, which is the Willamette Valley, which encompasses Salem and Eugene and Portland, and then there's the rest of us, okay? And all these things that we think that they should be looking at, and why are they not considering this, and why are they not looking at this, it ain't going to make a bit of difference how much data we come up with, how many experts we have, or whatever, because they see Oregon, basically, they being Northern Oregonians, the power brokers and so on, who are, I'm sure, all good people and love their grandkids and everything else, but it's like the Raj, it's like the British in India or something. We are the colony, and they are the masters, and it's much simpler for them to keep things so that we are a resource base down here, because it makes no difference to them whether I have 20 acres that I can make about 4 or 5 acre lots out of that people can live on or whatever. To them, Oregon is the Willamette Valley, and then this big green agricultural forest area.
Recreation area.
And they see horrific things happening in Washington County and Clackamas County and stuff, where the farmland is being gobbled up and everything else, and they're so worried that that will happen to the rest of the state. So my point is that they don't see things from anywhere near, they being most of the people that make the decision, whether in the legislature and LCDC or whatever, they don't see things the way we do. And it's not because they're bad people or anything else. They're from another country, okay? And until we have the representation in the legislature or on LCDC or whatever, or enough people are saying, wait a minute, you're talking about, you know, a real situation, people that have real lives and real forest property and so like that, we're rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. I mean, we might win a little one here and we might win a little one there, but if you're going to put all your energy in anything, it's like, how do we get more representation? Not just we, but Eastern Oregon, mm-hmm. you know, and the coast.
Yeah.
How do we get more representation yeah. in the legislature and on these agencies that make administrative rules where they understand that we are not the Willamette Valley? Things are different here. And yeah, we want the same ends, and we want the same goals and everything else, but you got to do it differently here. So I just feel like we should put a lot of energy into trying to convince them that this is our standard here and this was the standard over here, but ultimately, until we get better representation, until we have a better understanding that we are not the Willamette Valley, we are rearranging the head chair.
So how do you do that?
I know we've talked about it for a long time, but I just say, if anybody, if we're going to have our county commissioners or we're going to put any energy, whether it's the Realtors Association, Homeowners Association, it should be lobbying or working to get people that are on these agencies or that are elected as legislators that will go to Salem and say, hey, there's another Oregon up there. You know, and it's an important part of the economy, and it doesn't work the same way. So one sounds great, but it isn't the same as down here. But as long as the most, if 80% of the people who make the decisions view Southern Oregon, Eastern Oregon, the coast, as the way the British used to view India, we'll administer it, you just do what we say, you're a resource, we know what's best, then we will remain a colony.
Until there's a revolution.
I don't have a solution, I'm just saying that I think that we can spend a lot of time
revolution. Trying to
actually, think about this a lot, and I've looked at a lot of results. I think there's at least two keys, okay? Voter registration, okay? And voter turnout. And I've looked at a couple of guys crank different numbers, and it applies to us too, but if you took four counties in Eastern Oregon that had Dudley would be our governor, okay? So there's a lot of sort of apathy in Southern Oregon and probably Eastern Oregon. That's sort of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Oh, we're a colony and they run things, and we actually could change the direction if, mathematically at least, if we could make things happen.
But until it happens, I think the rest of it is spitting on the wind.
Yeah, Jack, right.
I think it's like you have to play with the belt. And to sit back and say, well, we need to get a new deck of cards before we can play this game. Well, do what you can do, an issue of momentum. We can only, in this case, to get our commissioners to send a petition. We don't have any capacity to make that petition work, but we do have the capacity to get the commissioners to the effort. And so I get back to, you do what you can possibly do. It's a small step, and you might call it rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. You know, this administration nationally goes on, you're probably right. But, meanwhile, I think we've got to live with the fact that the second coming is not tomorrow. We have no guarantees that we're going to have a total national economic meltdown. We have no guarantees that Obama's going to go away in 2012. And there's no guarantees that Richard Widman is going to have a reformation of attitude in January of next year. But we do what we can do. And I think we have to do that if you're going to ever see that change.
Well, I agree, Jack. I don't think we should not do anything. I'm just afraid that we're doing what we need to do, but it's just not going to be enough until there's a major change.
I think a couple things. One is that what we can do is make sure that our local ordinances are not as restrictive as state law. I mean, that's again why we're here. And it's still important, even though the state laws may be more so restrictive that it's hard to live with, but at least get us back as a local community to maybe that level, and then we have to move at the state level. I'll just tell you that our Board of Commissioners in Josephine County, there's no respect for them in the state of Oregon. It's the worst I have ever seen since I've lived here. And that's sad, because they will have no impact at the state level. They just will not. The only hope we have is possibly a legislator, and that's probably Jason Atkinson and Wally Hicks and Dennis Richardson. Those are our only three people that probably have any clout of any kind at the state level at this point in time. But the county has no value as far as the AOC is concerned. That just from the actions that have gone on in the last year, it's deteriorated as far as I can see and been told across the state. Turn that his hand on then, Jim.
I wouldn't overlook Bruce Hanna, too. I think he's their guy.
That's probably true, yeah.
And could I come up with another thought on this whole question of what do we do next?
Yeah.
Would be, as I recall, there were public meetings at the beginning. Maybe it's time to think about doing some of that with a product. It has the risk of making the commissioners look kind of like they're, oops, we should have been on board earlier or something. I mean, so you've got to be a little careful how you do that. But it would seem to me if we come up with some real suggestions and run by the public, if we can get the public to wake up, maybe, that helps.
The important word that you said is if. The word if. We could get the public to wake up. So that's the thought.
It would take somebody in the media to kind of help us along, I think. And I'm not sure who that would be.
I'm assuming we as a committee could go ahead and hold an additional public hearing if we wanted to. It doesn't say that we can in the order that we created this. So Jack and then Jim, I'm sorry, Jim first and then Jack.
I was just going to say, and this kind of piggybacks on Gordon, that the Northern California region is feeling the same frustration as Eastern Oregon and Southern Oregon in this whole agenda that's moving forward, because they feel like San Francisco to Los Angeles makes all the decisions in Sacramento for what happens to them, that they really have no say, so they have very little voice. And I have to say that, in listening to guys like Fred Kelly Grant, who were involved in MoDoc County with the coordination with the federal government, that's the only county in Northern California that still is logging, doing some mining and agriculture, and have not been forbidden from doing those things based upon certain agendas. And I think that if we have any chance, exactly what you said, until we change the legislative opinions and get involved with our organizations, be it the home builders and the realtors, in getting the right people elected or appointed by the governor in those powerful positions that understand rural Oregon as a separate entity to urban Oregon, I don't think that we do have a chance. And
so what did MoDoc County do differently?
Well, MoDoc County, Scott Conway, by the way, who is your forestry superintendent out of Medford for the whole district, he was the forestry superintendent down there when this all went on, and Fred Kelly Grant is an attorney that developed a coordination plan with the County Board of Superintendents out of MoDoc County, that they were starting to decommission all these roads and put all these rules and regulations on these ranchers and farmers, and they said, enough's enough. You're going to kill our economy. I mean, we're going to have no more private ownership land down here if you keep doing this, and we want a voice at the table. And they found out that federally that is, it's allowed. They're supposed to be having coordination with the local community over what they're doing on the lands in the county in which these people reside. And so Scott Conroy was very much, he was a U.S. Forest Service superintendent down there, and he said they sat right at the table with the BLM and them and the ranchers and the farmers and the Water Owners Association, and each one of them had standing in these meetings. And so since that coordination occurred, there's been constant talking between the agencies and the private citizenry down there as to what you can do and what you can't do in that particular county. Now that is spreading across Northern California into Siskiyou County, and Siskiyou County is trying to do the same thing with their county board of superintendents right now, their superintendents. Joe Spain County, Jack actually was appointed in this. There's a coordination panel of people that are working on the model, I guess you could say, or the format for coordination with this county and the agencies that are trying to run their own agenda without asking the general public or the community what we feel we'd like to see done also on some of these lands. So it's a different process, but it's a different way of being able to maybe tackle a greater giant, you know. And the giant that we're tackling right now with the state, though, you're absolutely right. I mean, I've been in the same fight. I've been in the legislative hearings. I've sat there, and we have very little say-so out here.
One quick thing is that apparently off of the meetings that have been occurring is that Scott Conroy and somebody are meeting with the board this week on an update. They didn't, all they show is the name. They don't show the agency that they're with, but they're having an update.
Good.
So I'll let you know what it is, because yeah, somebody will be a check.
And addressing somewhat of what Gordon's question, there's a little bit of confusion that might not be clear here. Jim is speaking to rip off the federal lands and coordination with whatever local plan the county might have. No equivalent thing in ordering law. Our state law is exactly the opposite, that we must comply with the agency. But I was going to bring this up under the heading of business. Way back when, it was suggested that we look into Powder River Corridor and the Wild Corridor and all that. And it occurs to me that what needs to be in our county land use plan is a demand for coordination by the federal agencies regarding any of their rules or management activities that are going to impact the interface or have direct impact upon private property such as Trenor Experience. And if we have that in there, then whatever they undertake to do will have to be in coordination and compliance with whatever our plan is.
What document would that be?
We would add it to our comprehensive plan for the land use plan. Just a requirement that anything that's going to impact, as did the situation with the Senate property, be coordinated and consistent to the extent allowed by law with the local development plan.
Is that applied for the state?
No. This only works because of what law, which is the Federal Lands Policy Management Act and the Forest Service Management Act. Each of those, and even the Endangered Species Act, all of these goofy things have a provision in there that federal government agencies, in the development of their management plans for specific areas, have to be in coordination with local plans if there is a local plan. And by coordination, that's not just discuss and cooperate, that's adjust the federal plan to the local plan unless there's a legal reason for not doing so. And so that again, as they are expanding these corridors, BLM especially, and they're impacting not simply their public lands, but they are impacting private lands and the use of private lands, they should be in compliance with whatever county set up.
Is there any verbiage at all in our comprehensive plan that addresses that state?
Not that I know of.
No, I don't think there is.
Is this for October?
I'd like to request that for October also.
Yeah. We have it on agenda for October.
Trying to answer that question. Originally, when the Wild Scenic Park, they had a wild river zone in the county.
Yeah.
But that was a very short-lived beast, and it really didn't function well, so it went away. The catch with most of the river stuff is that it's under scenic easements, which are a pretty powerful document. It says what you can and can't do. And it'd be interesting to try and coordinate that, but I don't quite see how that would work. Maybe I've overlooked something.
Well, that would be part of at least the discussion on the committee that he's on, mm-hmm. on that coordination, would be those scenic easement issues, and I would think. I mean, is that part of it?
That whole plan is directed towards public lands. Our comprehensive development plan is directed towards private lands. The main concern we would have is when a government agency, such as BLM, undertakes some kind of management plan that would, indirectly impact interface areas, or B, directly, as in Turner's case, impact, that in those circumstances they must coordinate with our plan.
I would see this going forward, but probably not backwards. I think that was a new idea.
It just goes retroactive, it can only be prospective.
Yeah.
Grace, did you have your hand?
Well, I just found something.
Okay.
It specifies in the code, which is the specific part we probably should look at. It says, mandatory changes in federal and state law shall apply as they become effective and must be followed and applied even though such laws conflict with one or more provisions of this code. I know, but that's what I'm saying.
It's the law, the coordination law, cannot require them to violate the law. And so if there's a new law established under the federal code, that's it.
Right.
But when you have a local management plan,
mm-hmm.
okay, that's another cat altogether.
Mm-hmm.
We can definitely skin that one.
Okay. I just don't think it says anything about working with a federal agency. You know, if a federal or agency or state is going to impose a federal agency is going to impose a regulation on the county, basically this is saying we're just going to kowtow and go under and obey it. It doesn't say anything about working with them, coordinating.
No, but what he's talking about on federal land, not private land, and this is all about private land.
Well, no, he's talking about when a federal law impacts private land. They're supposed to be working with the local county, which would be the private code.
No, you're missing the concept. When the federal agency develops a management plan for the use of their land, it's simply a plan.
Not a law.
Not a law.
Yeah, okay.
That management plan, which presumably is the implementation of some greater law, that management plan itself must coordinate with the local plan unless there's a federal law that is...
Okay.
Hey, Jim.
These scenic easements, you know, I have just dealt with this recently on a property on Riverbanks Road, where it was above Riverbanks Road, but it still was in the viewscape of the Rogue River. There were people coming around on the boat there, and these people wanted to build a house up on this 10-acre site. And that property, I mean, it was specifically stated in the deed restrictions that it falls into the scenic easement area. And so the viewscapes in there are really sensitive, and they're a lot bigger than people realize, at least from certain reaches of the Rogue River downstream, like from Shorter Park, let's say, downstream. There are some real viewscape and scenic easement issues that you have to be sensitive to, just the way that the feds have it set up right now. And again, I think that's what Trenor was saying, you know, and I like what Jack said, is that we can only go forward. We can't go retroactive, unfortunately. You know, I mean, I wish
some people have been able to do that.
Yeah, some people maybe.
Okay.
I want to go back
to the future. This is going to be a topic of discussion then on the October meeting?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other issues? We'll sort of jump up as far as there's no subcommittee, so any other matters that any commission members may have that they want to bring up? I have one, a question on access permit. Maybe you can answer. Do those have an expiration date? If somebody has a piece of property and they have get an access permit, is there a time frame on those permits, or is it, why would there be? If it's good, does the permit go with the land? If I have a piece of, say, a ground.
An encroachment permit?
No, it's an access permit.
Driveway permit
or access permit. The county issues them to people when they come in, I guess, to develop or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Once they get the permit, why would it go away? If it does. I don't know whether it does or...
Well, it does and it doesn't. It does expire if there is some land use that's brought to planning. Say somebody wants to build, replace a house or something, where there's going to be some activity on that property. Then if 3 years or more has elapsed since that property was last issued the permit, we like to go out and take another look at it to see if there's been deterioration or something like that that could affect a county road. If you got a permit 10 years ago and nothing ever happened on that property that we felt would trigger another look, it just goes on. Technically, it has expired, but just because the three-year window is over, we don't say, oh, we have to go look at it again. It's all connected to planning and development permits.
ODOT's 90 days. If you don't get it done within 90 days after they issue the permit, it expires and you can reapply.
Why?
Because that's their rules.
Jack.
Traditional legal principle that cuts across land use, so on, whatever. Use it or lose it. You get a right, a permit, an entitlement, a judgment. If you don't use it, you don't act on it, it goes away.
90 days
is very short.
But the permit is for somebody to be able to access their property and use their property, whether they may be driving on it, but they may not have done anything with it.
Well, probably the big difference.
How do we?
The concept of easement, which is what you're grappling with.
No. No, I'm talking a direct access to, if you have a public road and this is a piece of property, and say I go in and get I'm going to build a house, and I have to, and yet in order to do that, you have to get an access permit, which they tell you, okay, here's what you have to do to access your property, if I'm reading it right.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you've done what they've asked, which is, whatever, the way
it
is. Yeah, whatever it is. And that's all there. And it sits there for whatever period of time. Someday there's going to be a house there, but I didn't build it within that year. I may be driving on it, but I'm not necessarily building on it. Building the house. But I guess I always thought that it should go with the land and it should be forever. As long, because you have access. You got to have access to the property. and why should it expire? I understand that maybe there may be some changes, but to require a new permit versus, say, going out and doing the inspection thing.
Does the access have an intent?
But it's for residential, or is there some? Yeah, I was trying to find it, and I couldn't. But the question came up to me, and that's why I raised it. It's another one of those issues that I guess it's a local policy issue that maybe we need to look at and understand it better. That's all I had on that. And I don't know how often you run into that. For access permits.
Probably not
a lot right now, but is it?
Right.
Is it a problem? I don't know.
That's just my money,
That's a problem.
Usually, once you build it, it doesn't deteriorate very rapidly. But what's Public Works concerns about that it might deteriorate or it might be?
Well, only deterioration, or which could subsequently cause tracking onto the road, because our concern is really. Limited to those first few feet, which is technically right of way. Mm-hmm. So we want to maintain the integrity of our right of way.
Mm-hmm.
And the 3-year window, if I remember correctly, when I first started here, I believe the window may have been 5 years, but it was different when Rob Brandis came in as the director. At some point in time shortly thereafter, we had identified a 3-year window.
But
which again is silent unless development is proposed, in which case we want to go out and see. Now, that could have been 10 years later or 20 years later. We don't keep tabs on it.
So you have to have a specific purpose to have the access? I mean, say you have a piece of property, and it's just property, and yet you want to be able to get in and out of that property, and you have to have permission from the county to be able to cross their right of way to get to your property.
Mm-hmm.
And whether I'm doing anything or not, if I just want an access, I can get an access permit for no other purposes.
Yeah, because you can't do anything else until you do that. You can't even get a development permit until you
right.
The
That's
very
right.
first thing you have to do is get the access permit, and once they go out, you drive your stake where you're going to do it, and you're people go out there and look at it, and they say, yeah, that's okay. You put your culvert in and some gravel on top of it, you've satisfied the requirements of the access permit, right? You don't have to build a house in the next 10 years. You put in your access. You can't even get a development permit. That's step one. Before you even go to planning permit, you got to come here.
Right, and that was established back in 2002, as you probably remember.
But I didn't realize there was a time frame. I guess I've always assumed that once somebody got that access to that property, and I may have sold, say I got it originally and I sell it to somebody else, and then they decide they're not
ready. Well, the reason I can see, Harold, it kind of goes back to one of the other discussions we had, is that you get an access permit for a particular driveway to access property, and then you don't even put the culvert in, you don't do anything. And in the 5 years, I or Tom Toby puts in a subdivision of 20 lots down the road, so now you have much more of a flow down the ditch or something, and they go, well, that. I'm just speculating here that, we said you only needed a 12-inch culvert, but now we've got all this water going down there, and we require a 16-inch.
Right, or maybe some other circumstances, naturally caused or otherwise, might dictate that there be a change. And only through an inspection can you make that determination.
So the lesson is, once you get it, get your culvert in there, put some gravel down, and
does that apply to subdivisions, too? I mean, if a subdivision is a 5-acre subdivision, and you've got all these lots in, and they've all been given access permits, passed to the septic and everything, does that apply to a subdivision? The 3 years?
No, that's because there's no activity on that road, supposedly. I mean, we're not talking about a traveled county road until such time as there is development that takes place.
I guess what I'm hearing is that maybe it's worth at least just having a discussion on it at one of our meetings.
Oh, I think
as
so.
An issue to
do it.
I mean, so if that's okay with. I mean, it's a local issue. It's local. There's no state law that governs how or what should be done. It's something that the local.
Yeah. Now, my experience with Public Works has been, if you put the approach in and say you didn't build a house, and you come back later and say, I need to get the development permit now because it's expired and we need to do it, it's gone past 3 years, they go,
we'll go take a look at it, and if everything's, you know, still in place, fine, you don't need to do anything. But there's been other things, like they had this property that they wanted to be able to pull farm trucks off of, and they said, no, without a development permit, you don't get your driveway permit. If you don't have a use other than just trying to pull that farm truck onto that property, we're not going to issue the access permit. Now, probably a unique circumstance.
Oh, boy, I never heard of that.
Well, that was Al Bruner, and there was a bunch of flat going on over there, but he had three legal lots. He had access for one, and he wanted to get an access for the other one, and he was going to, even when his PUD fell apart, because he didn't do it the right way, but to pull a hay truck in there, they said, no, without a proposal for an actual development on the property, we will not issue
an
access.
Going on.
It's one of the reasons that part of the discussion on it is based upon the River Road property, the old hop yards.
Mm-hmm.
And they have access, there's three accesses on Lower River Road that's onto the state highway, but they have absolutely no access permits. They never have. And those are basically legal. I don't think they have access permits on Lower River Road. I don't believe onto the old hop yard.
So anyway, that's
what brought about the discussion.
State plays by a completely different set of rules.
I understand that.
Because I had one out on Highway 62. That driveway had been there forever, and it didn't show up in their logs, even though it's been there for 30 years. They wanted a new driveway access permit and go look at that access because it was a state highway.
I just think it's worth probably looking at because it does have some ramifications as far as the properties and how you can use or not use them. And just
I like it. I'm glad that you brought it up. I'm seeing some interesting things right now in Cape Junction where they're actually decommissioning some accesses that have been in there for 40 years into commercial properties and stuff for a safety corridor. And nobody thought that they could do this, but they're doing it. And that's the state. That's ODOT. They come in, they do whatever they want.
Yeah. That's a policy issue with them. That's another whole other ball.
Because I heard there was a candy bar in one of the pieces of equipment.
Okay. Any other issues or thoughts, comments? So Ann will send out an email letting you know the time and the place for the commissioners' meeting with the planning director on Thursday. We've got about four items so far at this point that are set up for our October meeting to include. Gordy's one that we did in erosion control, and I guess we need to be prepared to. Well, we've already covered that. So, anything else that we have? And I had a conversation with Dave Winker. Winker's that his last name? Winker.
Wechner.
And I basically told him I didn't think there was a need to have a planning staff person here other than Ann for our notes. Because at some point we've had a lot of folks come in. It costs the county money for these folks to come in on their time off. And so Dave was, we had two of them coming. Of course, I understand that with Dave being new, he wanted to understand how our system worked. But I didn't feel at this point there was a need to have any staff person in our meetings at this point, unless you folks feel otherwise.
Would you do me a favor? Would you tell them just how much that had cost?
Huh?
Would you please tell this group how much he reported to you that it would cost?
Oh.
Like when we discussed it at the meeting, it was $4,000.
Somewhere in there.
A meeting?
No.
For the year. Yeah, for the year. I think it was for the first part of our...
The first part was close to $25,000.
Yeah.
What?
And this part was close to
$37,000. Yeah.
Just for these meetings.
Can we get some kind of breakdown on that?
He did. He did the breakdown.
Yes, yeah. I did the breakdown.
I don't think we got it from anybody.
I don't think he did. I did the breakdown.
Does that include your time during
that includes
hours?
My time. Yeah. That includes my working time. That includes all the time, staff time during our working hours, not only in attendance all our working hours that we have to compile all this stuff. The bulk of it is my time because I have to attend, I have to compile everything, I have to do the minutes, I have to make sure everything is organized. So the bulk of it is my time.
Well, you're worth it,
Ann. I know it.
Yeah.
I know it.
Money well spent.
We get Ann to spin that breakdown out to everybody, too.
Sure.
I had no idea that we were. So, we could have gone to PG and looked at land use planning.
That's money that does not, that's just lost money.
Does that count that Nora's time and or
no.
Rob?
No, it does not count their time at all.
And basically the rationale was that the commissioners had provided about
$5,000 a year.
No, but it came out of lottery. And there was the $5,000, but there was also
it was $5,000 from the economic development. And that was what was for each fiscal year, $5,000 a year for the 2 years, so $10,000 total.
So, which did not include the staff. But anyway, that we can get that to you. So anyway,
our checks are discussion.
I was going to say, where do I send Michael? That's
how now we know why.
I do it. I need double time or half price.
And nobody does anything with what we produce.
that would be really annoying.
We just exist as a excuse for a conduit to the state money to preserve our planning department.
Hypothetically, we did something.
Anyway, I do want to compliment Ann because I got to tell you, in all the years that I've been involved, that these are probably some of the best minutes and coverage of a meeting that I've ever had. I mean, it's very clear, and I have confidence in the.
That's thanks to Grace. Grace and Carol were the ones that hired me early on.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. All right. Good job.
Well, you think this.
Okay, so October 10th, 6 o'clock here. And we'll see what shakes loose. One thing I made on 3615, there is a movement on the part of Jackson County to try to convince DLCD to utilize their administrative rule process to move forward with the 3615 document that was brought before the legislative process. We're not sure that's going to get a lot of traction, but if it doesn't, they are going to be resubmitting it at the legislative session in February. But there's also, I talked with Sean Julian this last week, and they are trying to push to see if they might be able to get DLCD to come up with, or Richardson to help come up with some dollars if they could do it through the administrative rule process rather than waiting for February. So there is some movement at this point in time, but I haven't seen a whole lot of this. They know that everybody wanted it to happen except Peter Courtney, and he's the one that stopped everything. If it had gone through, the governor wants it to happen. It had almost completely unanimous approval in the legislative process, except for Peter Courtney, and he held it up just because of a marine bill over on the coast that the Thousand Friends of Oregon wanted, and the Republicans didn't want it to happen. So, and it would have been a far more restrictive issue over on the coast for those folks. So that killed the whole thing. So, so it could move forward. See what happens. So we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.